Welcome to the Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and podcast on Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 and 103.7, and streaming live at radiofreenashville.org.
It's hard to even convey the idea that in this world today that children are being amputated, having limbs amputated as a result of traumatic injury without anesthesia. And by the way, there's plenty of anesthesia medicine at the border of Egypt waiting to enter Gaza.
That was Steve Sosby of the Palestinian Children Relief Fund, Palestinian Children Relief Fund. And you will hear more from Steve and other voices, including genocide scholar Rod Siegel. But first, my name is Jim Wohlgemuth, and I'm here with fellow Vietnam veteran Harvey Bennett. We're members of Veterans for Peace. Veterans for Peace is an international organization of military veterans and allies whose collective efforts are to build a culture of peace, humanity, equality, and justice. Just go to veteransforpeace.org. This radio show and podcast is on stations across the country, thanks to the Pacifica Radio Network. We're also on SoundCloud, Anchor Podcast, Spotify, and your phone podcast app. Just search Veterans for Peace. The Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and Radio Free Nashville are supported in part by you, the listener, because it is you that keeps Radio Free Nashville going. And as a result, this show is then picked up by the Pacifica Radio Network. So we are heard across the country. So if you think this is important, just go to radiofreenashville.org and click on the donate button and keep Harvey and I on the air in every time zone. And of course, if you support the work of Veterans for Peace, go to our site, veteransforpeace.org. There's a donate button there also. Harvey?
There was a big article in the Times today. It was the first one that popped up, and it's all about Times investigation reveals widespread systematic rapes by Hamas on October 7th. And all these interviews with dozens of witnesses and saying photographs and videos and, you know, it's been, October 7th, November 7th, December 7th, almost 3 months. And all of a sudden, they're showing up with all this stuff that Israel has not shown to anybody.
A little suspicious, I think.
It wouldn't be the first time the Times has shown up to do what had to be done, since it's crunch time for the genocide.
That's a really good way to start. We also need to recognize, Harvey, that this is our first show of our ninth year. Mm. I think we ought to thank all the people who have tuned in over the years. And we want to thank Radio Free Nashville for giving us this platform through which we can try to make a difference by sharing the message of Veterans for Peace and to help us feel like we are staying relevant.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, today's show just continues what we've been discussing for weeks. And that is, of course, the genocide that has taken place right under our eyes. We are watching it in real time. And for most of us, most Americans, we disapprove, but we feel hopeless as all our efforts to try to stop it seem to fall on deaf ears.
Particularly the two deaf ears of Joe Biden. Nothing can stop the genocide without a ceasefire. That has to be the first thing. You can't address the extreme deprivation and, you know, starvation and humanitarian crisis and suffering there.
So today we have a number of clips to share from Breaking Points and Democracy Now! And elsewhere. And so right now we're going to start with Crystal Ball on Breaking Points.
A viral message from a Palestinian reverend in Bethlehem. We also have new evidence emerging, including videos of potential war crimes. We have a new report from the Washington Post comparing this level of destruction in Gaza to all other wars this century and finding that already in just this comparatively short period of time, this surpasses the brutality and destruction of anything that we have seen this century. They've got maps and data to prove that. So as well, we've also got some new data coming out of Israel about just what Israeli Jews want to see in the quote unquote day after. Spoiler alert, it's ethnic cleansing. And clearly this is also what their political leaders are pushing for as well. And lastly, we've got, this is a huge development, Israel allegedly assassinating one of Iran's top generals. Dr. Teresa Parsi had a really important thread breaking down what this could mean, what Israel could be pushing for here. And of course, this, you know, sparking concerns, additional concerns of a potential regional war, which would certainly directly pull in the United States of America.
So that was our introduction. And we recommend anybody go to YouTube and click on Breaking Points, because Crystal and Sagar do a really good job of kind of synopsizing all this horror that's going on from there. The point that she makes there is, and it's, I think it's a point that's really lost on Americans, that we have not seen such a concerted effort at genocide in our lifetimes. In Vietnam, we killed hundreds of thousands over years, over decade. In Iraq and Afghanistan, we killed, the United States killed hundreds of thousands. But this has been going on for just 12 weeks. This is just targeted. There is absolutely nothing strategic about this. Where do you want to go from here? The pastor?
Yeah, I think that pastor clip that she had was very good, because it's
and if you want to
so well.
Yeah, if you want to find most of the clip for the pastor in Bethlehem.
That's
Democracy on Democracy Now.
Right, yeah, they have that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, but I wanted to start with a viral Christmas message from a reverend in Bethlehem, sharing his thoughts on what is happening. This is Palestinian Reverend Munther Isaac preaching in Bethlehem on December 23rd. Let's go ahead and take a listen to what he had to say.
Gaza today has become the moral compass of the world. Gaza was hell before October 7th, and the world was silent. Should we be surprised at their silence now? If you are not appalled by what is happening in Gaza, if you are not shaken to your core, there is something wrong with your humanity. And if we as Christians are not outraged by the genocide, by the weaponization of the Bible to justify it, there is something wrong with our Christian witness, and we are compromising the credibility of our gospel message. If you fail to call this a genocide, it is on you. It is a sin and a darkness you willingly embrace. Some have not even called for a ceasefire. I'm talking about churches. I feel sorry for you. We will be okay. Despite the immense blow we have endured, we the Palestinians will recover. We will rise. We will stand up again from the midst of destruction, as we have always done as Palestinians. Although this is by far maybe the biggest blow we have received in a long time, but we will be okay.
Very powerful words there. And I intentionally began with that, not only because of the season, appropriate message for the season, I suppose. I do think there will be a time not long from now when everyone looks back and is horrified by the atrocities that have been committed here on a daily basis, with the not only acceptance, but the United States, the most powerful country in the world, aiding and abetting these crimes, shipping weapons, providing diplomatic cover, providing rhetorical cover, you know, doing this, playing this game of pretending like Joe Biden and co are really concerned about civilian lives, which is, at this point, just a ruse to try to buy Israel even more time to commit the atrocities that they've been committing.
So there was her reflection and calling out the churches, calling out the Christian churches. And I don't know how many of our listeners go to church, Harvey, but it's one of those things where your pastor needs to be calling for a ceasefire.
Yeah, I haven't heard it at my church.
Well, thankfully I've heard it in mine, just calling for a ceasefire. All right, where do you want to go from here? I mean, there's so much.
She talks about something about executions.
You always get these questions of like, oh, why are you so focused on this? There are lots of terrible things happening in the world. And that's true. Lots of terrible things happening in the world. But even with that being said, on the level of starvation, on the level which I'm about to show you, of the destruction of buildings, just total, you know, turning the whole landscape into a moonscape or a parking lot, destroying all kinds of civilian infrastructure. This is the worst this century, and certainly in terms of the number of children killed, which is significantly over 10,000 kids killed at this point. You know, this is like nothing else that we have seen in recent history. And then you add to that, as an American citizen, the fact that, you know, when you're sending in your taxes here in the new year, they are going for some of these 2,000-pound bunker-busting bombs that have been indiscriminately dropped all over Gaza. Many tons of weapons and ammo just being shipped by Biden to Israel. So all of their, you know, supposed concerns about civilian life and, oh, we've been having these tough conversations, total and utter nonsense. Total and utter nonsense. So we talked before about reports of summary executions. We also talked previously on Breaking Points about how they were rounding up civilian men, stripping them naked, posting pictures of their, you know, utter humiliation. Even Israel admitted after those roundups that the overwhelming number of those who had been, you know, rounded up, stripped naked and humiliated in this way, that they were civilians who had been rounded up, hands on their head. They're using an empty soccer field or football field to conduct these, you know, mass detentions. This is from Rami Abdul with Euromed Monitor, and they have a report about alleging these war crimes and documenting some of the summary executions. What he writes here is field executions and mass detentions, alarming footage of Israeli forces turning a stadium in Gaza into a mass detention camp. The video shows the detention of hundreds of civilians, including women, elders, and babies. Euromed Monitor has confirmed that the Israeli forces are carrying out field executions against civilians in Gaza after forcibly removing them from displacement centers and stripping them. So they have pulled together a report that they have submitted to UN rapporteurs and the ICC prosecutor. This is a primary report documenting dozens of field execution cases in Gaza. The human rights group requested an immediate investigation into these crimes, calling for the perpetrators to be held accountable and for justice for all victims. If you read through this, they have documented multiple instances of what they describe as crimes and liquidations that they have submitted with evidence in order to, you know, start an investigation, hopefully, and some accountability, hopefully. Wouldn't hold my breath on any of this, because the truth of the matter is, I think after what we're seeing unfolding here with the active participation of the United States and with, you know, us providing diplomatic cover, et cetera, like, any idea that human rights, war crimes, that any of this matters, I just don't know how you sustain it. And we are truly back to, you know, pre-World War II period. And that comes out in Netanyahu's rhetoric, of course, where he says, oh, well, you know, we're not doing anything different than what the Allies did and what you all did in terms of World War II. And anytime anyone says that, remember, first of all, there is actual data to show that the level of destruction in Gaza now surpasses what we did in places like Dresden that were synonymous with mass civilian casualties and destruction of civilian infrastructure. But second of all, there's a reason why after World War II, we put in place things like the Geneva Conventions so that civilians would face some level of protection and so that we wouldn't have the horrors unfolding again that we saw in wars like World War II.
And that was Crystal Ball from Breaking Point. So, Harvey?
Yeah, Euromed is a great source. People should be aware of that. And you can go to their website. It's just Euro-Med. And they're a human rights monitoring group based in Geneva, I believe. And they really are keeping close account of what's going on there. And you can get a lot of information from them. I just pulled it up. And this just says, day 82, Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip, 29,124 dead, 56,000 injured, 101 journalists killed.
How many dead?
29,124, which is an undercount. That's not.
But 29,000.
Yeah.
Because that's significantly higher than what we're reporting, what even Amy is reporting.
481 health staff killed or wounded, 183 mosques damaged or destroyed.
And what's this website?
It's called Euromed, Euro-Med monitoring.
And it's a dot what?
Human Rights Monitor.
Human Rights Monitor. And it's a dot org.
And that's where Crystal's getting her stuff. These are not opinion pieces. This is data.
So, Nick, why don't we just use the clip from Democracy Now! About the two boys
Steve Sosby, our deepest condolences. If you can talk about these
two. This is
two,
Amy Goodman from Democracy
people who
Now.
Were children when you met them, when they were brought to the United States, you brought them to get them medical care and now killed in the Israeli attacks in Gaza. Tell us about them.
Both of them were amputees. Both had been shot by snipers during the Great Return marches of 2018. They were teenagers who were participating in peaceful protests at the gates. At the borders of Gaza. They're refugees. They were born into refugee camps in the Gaza Strip. Their families were the descendants of refugees from 1948 when the State of Israel was created, and were, as all refugees in Palestine, demanding the right to return to their villages, to their homes, to their towns within Israel. During these protests, both had suffered below-knee amputations from the result of being shot by a sniper. And our organization, as a humanitarian organization, identifies these kids who need medical care they can't get locally. And the quality of prosthetic care in Gaza before October 7th was really underdeveloped and in need of improvement, which we were working on. So these kids were brought outside for treatment. Izzedeen was brought to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where he was provided a new leg and taught to walk again. And Mohammed was brought to Dayton, Ohio, where the same thing. Both of them were provided below-knee prosthetics for free. Both of them had great experiences during their treatment. They flourished being outside of Gaza for the first time in their lives. And when we sent them back home, as we do with all of our injured kids, both of them started to have a new hope in life. For the first time since their injuries, they were able to go back to school. They were becoming independent. They were mobile. In the case of Izzedeen, we even hired him to become a field worker for our organization. And one of the areas that he was quite interested in was photography. I've been in touch with both of them during the war, the bombings in Gaza, and Izzedeen in particular I was quite close with because I had taken him back home after his treatment. And he had mentioned that, you know, he was still alive, because that's the communication you have with people in Gaza these days. It's just a very basic, are you still alive? It's not much else you can really say. I hope you're okay. It's kind of a painful way of expressing your sympathy and support for the people there. And, you know, he was always responding, yes, I'm fine. How are you? And then recently was asking, you know, how can I do more to help my people? I'm looking for ways to be part of, you know, humanitarian work here on the ground during this terrible crisis. So even during this period, a boy who had lost his leg and who was disabled for the rest of his life, in a certain sense, was looking for ways to help his own people during this terrible crisis. And both of them are, as you mentioned, two of six kids that we brought to the United States who've been killed over the past 2.5 months. It's hard to even convey the idea that in this world today that children are being amputated, having limbs amputated as a result of traumatic injury without anesthesia. And by the way, there's plenty of anesthesia medicine at the border of Egypt waiting to enter Gaza. There's plenty of food at the border of Egypt ready to enter Gaza. Children are starving. People are starving in Gaza. It's not as if there's some kind of natural disaster that's preventing anesthesia medicine to come into Gaza and be able to be utilized to treat injured children. This is absolutely unimaginable that this is happening in this modern world. And we're witnessing it, and everybody sees it, and nothing's changing. The fact that there's now 1,000 new amputees, at least, and that number is going to grow because a lot of these kids are with insignificant injuries in which their limbs are going to have to be amputated in the coming weeks and months. Let's keep in mind, not only were they amputated without anesthesia, but many of them were amputated in a very quick fashion. And, you know, God bless the doctors and nurses in the health sector in Gaza. They are the true heroes in this, if there are any heroes in this, and there are, of course, among the Palestinian health workers. They're the ones who are day and night in the hospitals, exhausted as their own families are living under bombs and being killed, trying to help their own patients. And they're doing these amputations in a very quick manner because they have so many injured cases coming in. And a lot of these kids who are suffering traumatic amputations have to have surgery again in the future, and even further amputations, because they're not getting the adequate care in the initial stages of the amputation. So they're going to need revision surgery. So there is no services at all in Gaza for amputees. The hundreds of kids that we've treated over the years who've suffered traumatic amputations in Gaza, like Mohammed and Izzedeen, who were killed this week, those kids, their limbs are breaking down. They're being destroyed. They need to be adjusted. They need to be repaired. So these kids are now going again without limbs. And you can imagine under these circumstances, once again, being dependent on others to carry you around or being on crutches, while your neighborhoods are being bombed or your refugee camps are being bombed, is just an unimaginable situation. And this is the reality. There's absolutely no services available for them right now.
Well, on November 25th, during the seven-day truce, Defense for Children Palestine filmed an interview with 12-year-old Dunya, who lost her leg in an Israeli airstrike that killed her whole family. Dunya then was herself killed on December 17th after an Israeli tank-fired shell hit her while she was recovering in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunus. This is part of her interview with Defense for Children Palestine, which we're playing posthumously.
That was Amy's colleague, Nermeen Sheikh, on Democracy Now!
When they shelled us with the second missile, I woke up and was surrounded by rubble. I realized that my leg had been cut off because there was blood and I had no leg. I tried to move it, but it wouldn't move. My father and mother were martyred, my brother Mohammed and my sister Dalia too. I want someone to take me abroad, to any country, to install a prosthetic leg, to be able to walk like other people, so that I can move and go out and play with my siblings. I want to become a doctor, like those who treat us, so that I can treat other children. I only want one thing, for the war to end.
And this is what needs to be pointed out, as Amy said in the early part of the show when she mentioned the statistics of over 8,000 children in Gaza have been killed. They've been killed by bombings. They've been killed by traumatic injury. What about the children who have heart disease, who need medical care they can't get in Gaza anymore? What about the kids who have neurological disorders or have cancer, who have other types of, in many cases, quite serious injuries or diseases that they otherwise would get through our medical teams coming in or through the health system being available that can do elective surgeries, no longer having access to care, treatment, kids with diabetes, kids with dialysis. All of these children no longer have medical care, and they're dying, or they're not getting treatment. In many cases, their conditions are getting worse and they're suffering. What about the kids that are now in these internally displaced areas, like these UN schools, where they're sharing a toilet with 700, 800 people, all these communicable diseases going around within these small communities or these huge communities now of internally displaced people? They're getting sick. They don't have access to primary care. And in some cases, these children are dying. Add to that the fact that significant number of children now in Gaza are suffering from hunger and from starvation. All of these factors, in addition to the over 8,000 children that have been killed through bombings of their homes and of their schools and of their mosques and churches and hospitals, you add all of those numbers up, and it's an absolute humanitarian catastrophe far beyond what anybody can even articulate properly in words. It's unimaginable. We're going to do what I'm going to do in the future is every one of these children needs not only a new leg to walk again and to have their bodies repaired, but they need long-term healing. They need an opportunity to develop themselves into doctors. We have to give them that opportunity. Their lives are being destroyed. Their lives are destroyed, but they want hope for a better future. We have to come together as a community. We have to come together as people who have love in our hearts, not hatred, and serve these children for the long term. Develop programs where kids like Dunya, who's 12 years old without a leg, God rest her soul, have a chance for a better future. We have to take that responsibility. We're going to take that responsibility. That's the only way we can bring peace and healing to the children of Gaza during this nightmare of suffering and death that they're enduring today.
That's hard to hear.
I want to make sure people understand, and I want everybody to get a pencil and a piece of paper. So hopefully you've got it. Hopefully you're not driving. That guy was talking. He is the founder or the president of a significant organization called the Palestine Children's Relief Fund, PCRF.net. That's the website. P is in Palestine, C is in children's, R is in relief, and F is in fund. And as soon as this was over, I got on my phone and I sent them some money. Good Lord, to work hard to get six of these children. And how many other stories does he have? But six of these children, to bring them to the United States and have them fixed up and then have them go back and be killed. I don't know how many times I get up from Democracy Now! And I'm sick to my stomach, or listen to these other independent news broadcasts and I'm sick to my stomach.
And it's a cumulative thing. I feel like the longer this has been going on, the more distress I'm feeling about it all. And you keep hearing things that you couldn't have even imagined. And you know there's a lot going on that you're not hearing.
And this article that you just mentioned earlier about from the New York Times, it's apparent that I'm projecting my cynicism. At this late hour, 2.5 months later, and now you're bringing stuff up when from last week we have pictures of what Israel is doing to the men and the boys in soccer stadiums, stripping them down to their skivvies and making them kneel.
I don't know if you saw the report of 17 Israelis in the West Bank, I guess either settlers or IDF or both, raping an 11-year-old girl.
I did see that.
The Israeli response was that they were going to be disciplined, that this was a serious departure from the norm for their behavior.
Serious departure from the norm.
17 people, that's a serious departure. It's not an atrocity. I think we need to talk about some of the terms that are being used and abused. And one of them is human shield. I couldn't believe the other day that the Holocaust and genocide scholars are in two camps. And one camp, which supports Israel, says that what's happening in Gaza is not genocide because all these deaths are the fault of Hamas because they use human shields.
29,000 human shields.
So I tried to find out more on human shields. You know, under the Geneva Convention, it's defined as the intentional use by coercion or restraint of protected persons to shield military objectives or activities. If a Hamas member, whether he's a militia person or a bureaucrat in the Hamas government or a leader of some Hamas brigade, they have to live somewhere. They live in Gaza. People in Gaza don't have suburbs for the most part. They live in these high-rise buildings all over Gaza. And if one of them happens to live in a high-rise building with 200 or 300 civilians who have nothing to do with Hamas, it is illegal to kill these people. They're still protected as civilians. They're not human shields.
They're there. They just happen to be there.
They live there, and this other guy lives there. And if they know that person, they could wait till he leaves and then, you know, target him.
But they don't want to do that.
And we already know from 972 Journal that Israel has a well-designed, planned program of killing huge numbers of civilians, saying that that's have the shock effect that will turn the civilian population against Hamas.
Yeah, right.
That's terrorism. You know, I looked up terrorism, too. And there's an article was quoted from a book called Inside Terrorism by Bruce Hoffman, Columbia University, talking about how the, you know, the definitions of it have evolved over the years. His summary says, we may therefore now attempt to define terrorism as the deliberate creation and exploitation of fear through violence or threat of violence in the pursuit of a political end. Well, everything Israel is doing matches that description. All terrorist acts involve, not to mention the U.S. nuclear arsenal and other things.
Yeah.
All terrorist acts involve violence or the threat of violence. Terrorism is specifically designed to have far-reaching psychological effects beyond the immediate victims or objects of the attack. This is exactly what 972 described as the Israeli policy.
Now, what's 972 for our listeners?
972 is an online magazine or journal, which is very independent Israeli and Palestinian journalists. I've been subscribing to it for probably 10 years. Their articles are always excellent and well-referenced, and I highly recommend that. And, of course, now they're just indispensable to...
Can people just Google 972, or do you have to go to 972.org or something?
I think 972 would probably get it. Getting back to the definition of terrorism. Terrorism is designed to create power where there is none, or to consolidate power where there is very little. Through the publicity generated by their violence, terrorists seek to obtain leverage, influence, and power they otherwise lack to effect political change on either a local or international scale. So they're talking more about what they call liberation groups in colonized territory. Mm-hmm. Under international law, that's not actually terror, because terrorism is referred to as the illegal use. And the Geneva Conventions under occupation, belligerent occupation, permit resistance to occupation, including armed resistance. So that's a permitted activity.
So armed resistance, and you would be categorizing what Hamas did on October 7th as armed resistance, or is that going to be terrorism too?
It falls under the laws of war. So, and they did commit war crimes, the civilians that were killed.
Yeah.
Now, their attacks on government, on the military in Israel would not consider, would not be
no
terrorism or war crimes.
Because I understand that Hamas has fought back and has killed some 150 Israeli troops.
And this is Hamas inside Gaza. They're engaging with an invading military force, so that's not terrorism. But they're always referred to as terrorists. And the interesting thing is, what about the settlers in the West Bank, who they call extremists, but they don't call them terrorists?
No.
And these people who are setting fire to Palestinian villages, killing them, burning their property,
bulldozing their houses,
they're just called extremists or ultra-Orthodox. But then I never see the word terrorist attached to them. And clearly what they're doing is terrorism. And that's been the state of Israel's goal, really, since their inception, is to make life so unlivable and so traumatic and miserable for the Palestinians that they'll go somewhere else.
Now, and last week we had Ellen Davidson on. She defined and pointed out that Israel is an apartheid state. And then counterpoints had, because the other issue seems to be the discussion of genocide, and counterpoints, which is associated with Crystal and Breaking Points.
Ryan Grimm.
Ryan Grimm. They had a guy on calling this a textbook case of genocide.
We're joined now by Professor Roz Siegel, who is the Associate Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies, an endowed professor in the study of modern genocide at Stockton University, where he also serves as director of the Master of Arts in Holocaust and Genocide Studies.
That's the reason that we don't have many cases of mass violence since 1948 that are recognized as genocide. We can think about the Rwanda genocide, of course, and all the wars and violence in the former Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Only Srebrenica is recognized as an act of genocide, but there's very few. Why? Because perpetrators don't walk around expressing their intent explicitly and clearly. Here, in this case, they do. Again, we can think why this is, why we have such, you know, unashamed, clear, explicit, direct statements of intent that also happen, by the way, it's important to say, over time, right? It's not, as has been argued, just in the first week after the 7th of October, the Hamas-led attack and massacre of about 1,200 Israelis. No, it's over time, and it actually also uses various mechanisms of expressing this intent and also dehumanizing Palestinians, right? So intent is one thing that differentiates genocide from other crimes. So intent is explained in Article 2, where genocide is defined in international law. Another issue that differentiates genocide from other crimes is the legal obligation in Article 1 that once states recognize that there is a clear risk of genocide, or that genocide is already unfolding, but it's enough that there's a clear risk of genocide, right? There's an obligation to intervene to stop it and to prevent it, which is very different than other crimes in international law. Another issue is incitement, right? Which is, again, a different crime in the Genocide Convention. That's Article 3. But related, so incitement to genocide, which usually happens actually in media discourses, but also in political discourses, or in just in sometimes in public spaces in various ways. And it's important to say that Israel today, and anyone who follows Hebrew language sources, and they're all over social media today, and the Israeli media, Israel is, you know, very deeply immersed in a genocidal discourse. We see this in the media, since in the Israeli media since 7th of October. We see this in politics. We see this in public spaces, and I'm talking about, you know, huge signs hanging on the bridges of the Tel Aviv freeway right after the 7th of October, calling to flatten Gaza, to destroy Gaza, written on them directly that the image of triumph would be zero people in Gaza. So very direct, again, very explicit. It does not, you know, you don't need a degree in comparative literature to interpret these kinds of signs and statements. And but in the media discourse and in the political discourse in Israel after 7th of October, we see clear incitement to genocide, right? Clear incitement to genocide. And all this has been widely published, and we can, you know, I can repeat some of the quotes here if needed. But it's important to say that, you know, one of the cases that comes close to this kind of society immersed in a genocidal discourse perhaps is Rwanda, and the Rwanda genocide in 1994, that as the genocide was unfolding, right, we had journalists and radio people inciting for genocide, for the murder of Tutsis in that case. And it's important to say that in the ICTR, in the post-genocide trials, in the case of Rwanda, there was also a media case where journalists indeed stood trial and were convicted for incitement to genocide. So that's another element that actually differentiates genocide from other crimes in international law. And again, we see here, like the issue of intent, which is in Article 2 and refers to people with what's called command authority in international law. So state leaders, war cabinet ministers and senior army officers. Also, their statements are very clear, explicit, and unashamed. Also, incitement in Israel is clear, explicit, and unashamed. I mean, just yesterday or the day before, just to give a recent example, a journalist, Tzvi Chazkeli, on Channel 13 on the TV in Israel, just openly, outright, said that he thinks that at the beginning, Israel made a mistake, because it should have, the Israeli attack on Gaza should have been much more actually violent and severe, and it should have killed 100,000 Palestinians, right? Now, only the TV anchor said, are you sure that that's what you're saying? There was some exchange between them, you know, is this... all the other people there sitting had nothing to say, and the official response of Channel 13 of the Israeli TV to that was that it's, you know, that we're just expressing the plurality of, you know, positions in Israeli society, right? So this is outright unashamed, right? It's very common today in Israel, and it's something I think we should all be paying attention to.
Rin, I want to pick up on that point because, and I definitely don't mean this as a leading question, I'm genuinely curious, a lot of people in Israel are afraid that they live amongst other countries where it's not safe to be Jewish and where people engage in, by this definition of genocide, arguably a genocidal discourse. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that, not to suggest that there's any justification for, you know, sort of apples to apples in terms of military operations or anything like that. But is Hamas engaged in genocidal intentionality? Are they engaged in genocidal discourse? I know they're not a state actor in the same way. And maybe that's a sort of difference by the UN definition. I'm curious about that. But also countries like Iran, and the way that they approach, you know, just Jewish people who live around the world, who live in Israel. Does that, by the definition, the UN definition in 1948, does that sort of fit into it? How should we think about the way they discuss Jews?
Well, I think it's important to explain also that the UN definition requires five acts, right? It lists five acts that are considered genocide. So there's intent, there's the dynamics on the ground, but it's not directly in the convention, but it's very clear that genocide also requires capacity to carry it out, right? And if you don't have that capacity, so it's not, intent itself is not enough, right? You have to show the dynamics of violence on the ground in order to show genocide. And I think that in Israel's attack on Gaza now, we have, you know, enough evidence so far that the attack, as many experts now have said, is unprecedented in its intensity and its levels of killing and destruction, unprecedented, that is, since World War II, right? We have, as you said at the beginning, more than 20,000 Palestinians who have been killed so far. I mean, the north of Gaza is basically destroyed completely, and it's important to say that Israel's attack targets everything there: schools, mosques, universities, churches, agricultural fields, right? Israel has bombed from the beginning agricultural fields. Well, there is nothing there except agricultural fields, which tells us something, of course, about the intention of the attack. The levels of destruction: more than half of all the buildings in Gaza have been destroyed. The infrastructure have been destroyed. More than 2 million Palestinians have been forcibly displaced, right? Specific groups are targeted, right? Journalists, as we know very clearly, are targeted at least one or two on average a day, so that, you know, so it'd be very hard for Palestinians to actually document the attack against them. Healthcare professionals and doctors are targeted. Hospitals specifically are targeted, which is very, very important when we think about genocide and the total siege policy of Israel, so deliberately creating conditions of life calculated to bring about the destruction of the group in whole or in part, which is one of the acts of genocide in the convention. Targeting of hospitals shows us that very clearly. But for all of these things, you need capacity, right? And it's clear that the Hamas has no capacity to carry out a genocidal assault on Israel. It's important to say that the Hamas-led attack on 7th of October was a horrific and horrendous act of mass murder. It was a massive terrorist attack. It definitely involved war crimes and crimes against humanity that are also ongoing in the sense of hostage taking, right? There's no doubt about any of this. But Hamas has no capacity to carry out genocide. And also, we don't see in the case of Hamas this kind of the way that intention has been expressed and is being expressed in the case of Israel over time, using various mechanisms in an unashamed way. We don't see this actually in the case of Hamas.
So Hamas is a terrorist organization, and thanks to the United States or the United States support, and we need to emphasize that, Israel is genocidal.
We are complicit, which is prohibited under the law. Emily's comments about Jewish people in the Middle East and all this, I'm not sure how accurate all of that is. I know it's a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism, or at least anti-Zionism in the Middle East, and probably Jewish people might be targeted as connected with that. But I do recall, it's been a couple of years more, but when Iran was in the news a lot and talking about synagogues, and Tehran has, I forget how many synagogues, a significant number of synagogues, and they had a reporter, either Democracy Now! Or someone like that, who was in Tehran and going around to these synagogues, and he noted that none of them had any security around them. Their doors were not locked. And the Jewish people that he spoke to didn't convey any sense of fear or animosity toward them by the citizens there in Tehran. So you couldn't say that for Saudi Arabia, our ally. You can't even have a Christian church in Saudi Arabia without being beheaded. So I think that, you know, that's not something that shouldn't be a blanket assertion that the Jews are targeted, or, you know, would be slaughtered if they went to any other country.
Yeah, exactly. And just to help people who just listen to that, it was initiated by Ryan Grimm. He gave the introduction. Yeah. And the other commentator was Emily Jashinsky. I just did a quick search, and it's amazing how many synagogues are established throughout Iran. Let me ask you this, because I don't know how. Well, Crystal referenced this before. When this is over and in years to come, how does Israel recover? as far as being viewed as a legitimate government, a legitimate state. And with that, well, I don't know whether our reputation is ever recoverable.
No, I think any influence we could have ever had in the Middle East is gone.
Yeah. Other than putting carriers out, yeah, and bullying people.
Yeah. Even some of our big allies are, you know, getting a little hesitant to go full bore, you know, like the Red Sea operation.
Prosperity. That's
it. But I mean, even like Italy, France, some of them are just saying, we don't want to be part of that. You know, maybe we'll do something for our own shipping in there. But
that makes sense.
But, you know, that's a powder keg.
Crystal mentioned about a wider war.
At the same time, we have some dramatic developments in terms of Israeli actions possibly sparking a wider war. A top Iranian commander assassinated in a reported Israeli airstrike. Iran warned Israel will pay for the killing of Sayed Razi Mousavi, senior military advisor known as a close companion to the assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, senior advisor in Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, killed in Israeli airstrike outside the Syrian capital of Damascus on Monday. That's according to Iranian state media. Three security sources later confirmed Sayed Razi Mousavi's death to Reuters. Iran state television interrupted its regularly scheduled program to announce Mousavi had been killed, the wire reported. It was described in a Revolutionary Guard statement read on the air as a brigadier general and one of the Guard's most important figures in Syria, responsible for coordinating its military alliance with Iran. He was also described as a close companion to Qasem Soleimani, the top Iranian general who led the Guard's elite Quds force until he was killed in a U.S. airstrike in Iraq in January 2020. Undoubtedly, the usurper and savage Zionist regime will pay for this crime, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi said in Monday's televised statement. According to Iran's Tasnim news agency, this action is another sign of frustration, helplessness, and inability of the occupying Zionist regime. No immediate comment from the IDF, but it is widely expected and understood that Israel was probably behind this assassination. Israel, they say, was bracing for a response by Iran on its northern front, the Jerusalem Post reported later on Monday, citing local media reports. I will also add to that, there were some comments from Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant saying, we are fighting a war on seven fronts, and we have taken action on six of those. So this could be one of the fronts that they're referring to there in which they've taken action. We also have the U.S. separately, you know, ramping up attacks on these Houthi-related suicide drones. I think we shut down a dozen of them. That comes as they've been essentially blocking shipping through the Red Sea. And it's taking a huge toll, especially on the Israeli economy, also partly on the global economy. And the U.S. has marshaled this new coalition of the willing to try to restore the ability to traverse that shipping lane.
As soon as I heard that this general was killed, I thought Israel is trying to get us involved, because Israel kills an Iranian general knowing or hoping that Iran will respond and that would drag us in. Now, I want everybody listening to understand that we cannot get dragged in to another war in the Middle East. We cannot let ourselves do it. But I don't see how Biden would not do it. And I just now saw that one of our destroyers has gotten into a conflict with Houthi gunboats in the Red Sea. And we sunk 3 out of 4 and killed upwards of 10 Houthis. Not good.
No, I think they're painting us into a corner, the Israelis.
Yes. And so once again, here, Israel couldn't be conducting the genocide without our support. But it's not good enough for Netanyahu. He wants us involved, specifically, yeah, militarily involved.
Yeah. Well, the bigger, the longer the war, the longer Netanyahu can stay in power.
Right. And maybe he survives after that. I think that's what his strategy is.
But this is not just another Middle East war. I mean, Iran is not Iraq. Iran is not Syria.
And so who knows? Maybe the evangelicals who are hoping for a major world war coming out of the Middle East, so that we can have, that we can actually fulfill prophecy, initiate the end times. Maybe it's actually working, Harvey.
It's coming too close for comfort, that's for sure.
Coming too, that's right. And if the people, if the Jewish people throughout the world, and if the Jewish people in Israel don't realize that American support is primarily anti-Semitic, because as far as evangelical support, because they hope that the end times are coming when 2/3 of the Jewish population will burn in hell.
Yeah. Well, and
the other third are going to convert to Christianity.
That's just, you know, that's always been the way it's been. You know, look back at the Crusades, you know, Jews were given a choice of converting or death. Supposedly it was to claim the Holy Land from Muslims, but they never missed a chance to burn down a synagogue on their way.
Exactly. I mean, there's plenty of documented cases where crusaders coming from Britain or France stop off in Germany and burn down synagogues for practice for when they took on the Muslim community in the Holy Land.
Right.
For Christ's sake, Harvey.
Well, you know, I'm hoping, because I desperately feel like I need to be out there.
Yeah.
With some signs or ceasefire. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to try to maybe include in a letter to the editor or somehow get the word out is just quoting, you know, from the Hebrew Bible, not quoting the Amaleks and go back and, oops, you forgot to kill the women and children and livestock, which is the one they like. That's the verse they like. But from the prophet Micah. Micah is one of the minor prophets, but he's one of the most important ones in terms of the Jewish community, in, especially in the U.S. I don't know what it's like in other in European countries or wherever, but in the U.S., I've noticed that the temples that are the most progressive and where people can actually raise the issue of Zionism and not be thrown out on the street, where people feel, you know, comfortable being, a lot of them are named after the prophet Micah. It's Temple Micah. It's by far the most progressive reform synagogue there. The best known passage from the prophet Micah, and that is central to him, is basically asked the question, what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God? You know, wouldn't that be wonderful to see that posted in front of the Temple Micahs around the country?
That would be excellent.
And, you know, how do we reflect on the past 75 years and what could have been different? Path could have been chosen by those who established the State of Israel. And in fact, if you read the proclamation of the establishment of the State of Israel, the language in there includes that this will be a country with full rights for all peoples, regardless of their ethnicity, regardless of their religion. All this, it's in their proclamation.
Oops.
I don't know if they can go back and edit that out, but sometimes we just have to go back to the, you know, foundational things, the things that matter the most. And they say, when you go to scripture to prove your point, some people would call that taking the Lord's name in vain. But I think when what you're trying to do is stop a genocide, I think it's okay to do that.
Yeah, you're using it to stop a genocide while so many others are using other parts of the Bible, of scripture to justify their genocide. I mean, there's so much here, Harvey, and we've barely scratched it, but all I can think of is I want to make sure people remember, before we go, Palestine Children's Relief Fund, PCRF.net.
Yes.
And if you've got a chance, throw them some cash. I don't know whether I'm allowed to say that. But You know, they seem to be doing God's work.
They are. Also, Euromed, Human Rights Monitors.
Yes.
Also, Plus 972 Online Magazine from Israel.
Not to mention Democracy Now! And Breaking Points.
That's right. Knowledge is power there.
So, do you have a song?
We went to a Kwanzaa and things there, but people come in their traditional African dress.
Yeah. And
one thing I realized, I'm seeing all this incredible variety in what these people were wearing. And these are not people from Africa. These are Charlestonians, you know. But what we realized is this was not something we would see in Nashville. Charleston is unique in that the African community, Americans in Charleston, identify very closely with their African roots, because this is where they got off the boat. But you know, what I just felt from being at this celebration was, I mean, you just see so much honest, open friendliness and fellowship. Everybody knows everybody. And, you know, what's wrong with us white people?
That's right.
That's what why can't we do this, you know?
Exactly. I mean, I guess it's because we are so attached to capitalism, where capitalism does not like cooperation.
Well, or the, you know, Puritan ethic kind of thing.
Yes. Oh, my God.
That gives me a lot of hope to see these people, but they've been around for the long haul. And, yeah. You know, you think we're discouraged. They've been fighting the good fight all their lives, and they're not going to despair. They're going to be joyful, you know, just in defiance.
Yeah.
Of what they have to live in. Different people came up and saying, and this one guy came up and saying, change is going to come.
Wow.
And he was incredible. It was just fantastic. And maybe this time that would give us some hope to hear that.
Yeah.
Something's got to change, right?
Something's got to change. So, okay. So let's go with Sam Cooke.
Okay.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother. Say, brother, help me, please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Lord, there have been times able to carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know